Good afternoon. We'll call our third case for today and last case for the October arguments, 01-0724, 01-1031, 01-2486, Wixler v. Mitsubishi Heavy Industries America et al. The lineup for the arguments are 40 minutes for Attorney Habish, 25 minutes for Attorney Weber, 20 minutes for Attorney Bush, 15 minutes for Attorney Williamson, and 5 minutes for Mr. Habish. Right? Okay. Before we proceed, the court had a motion to strike the brief of Federal. Federal's brief related to the issue of punitive damages and its relation to direct action. The court, when it asked for supplemental briefs on the issue of the constitutionality of punitive damages, did not have that issue in mind. Came up when Travelers sought intervention in the prior case that we heard this morning, and not a new issue relating to direct action, and no one else has briefed that, so we do not want Federal to spend time on that argument and use its time for the issue of, as you wish, but not that argument. I assumed excessive damages, excessive punitive damages. So with that in mind, we'll hear from Ms. Habish.
May it please you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please you, members of the court. I'm Bob Habish, and I represent Patricia Wisher, Marjorie DeGrave, and Ramona Dudley Starr, individually and as special administrators of their respective late husband's estate. The legislature tried to make it harder to recover punitive damages by passing Wisconsin Statute 895-85-3, and they did, but not to the extent described by the Court of Appeals majority. So the issue before this court is how much harder they made it. We say the addition of the adjective intentional before the phrase disregard of plaintiff's rights elevated the state of mind of the actor so that now the disregard of rights must be purposeful and intentional. And words like wanton, willful, and reckless have been discarded. And so they have raised the minimum conduct required to get punitive damages in Wisconsin. In fact, they've made it tougher for the courts and juries to find justification for punitive damages. But what does the plain language of 895-85-3 not do? It doesn't convert common law disregard of rights into intent to harm or injury merely because the use of the adjective intentional. Nor does the word intentional as a modifier of disregard of rights make it an intentional tort. Nor does the word intentional as a modifier of disregard of rights suddenly change punitive damages from a remedy to a cause of action. Nor does disregard of rights conduct in the common law now suddenly become harm or injury.
Attorney, counsel, where does the term disregard of rights come from? What are we talking about?
Disregard of rights, Justice Wilcox, in the common law has been described as conduct. It's described as conduct in Wangen, it's described as conduct in Sharp, and it's conduct which leads to consequences or harm. So it is conduct. Now, the plain language of the statute, the plaintiff may receive punitive damages if defendant acted maliciously toward the plaintiff or in intentional disregard of the rights of the plaintiff. The legislature could have, but didn't, limit punitive damages to acted maliciously. They could have limited to acted with intent to cause harm to the plaintiffs. They could have used that language as a conjunction to malicious conduct. They could have stated, members of the court, that plaintiffs may only receive punitive damages as a result of intentional torts. But they didn't. The Court of Appeals looked at the plain language, declared it unambiguous, and then looked at extrinsic sources, none of which supported their interpretation.
Mr. Habish, if I can interrupt you for a minute, I'm a little concerned with the answer that you gave to Justice Wilcox. And this is my concern. If we talk about disregard of rights involving conduct which leads to consequences or harm, does that mean that every time someone is injured, that there could be a punitive damage claim?
Absolutely not, Justice Crooks. Here's the process. You still need to have a finding of compensatory damages by the underlying tort. That's number one. Number two, the court then will analyze the conduct which resulted in the compensatory damages. And they'll analyze to see whether there are aggravating circumstances in the conduct. And they'll look at it with a light as whether or not the actor was aware of the potential of harm and acted nonetheless in disregard of that harm or the consequences, and further, that acted in disregard of the plaintiff's rights. If the court feels that this conduct then caused actual damages, because that conduct has to cause actual damages, okay? If they feel that way, then they may send it to a jury. And then the jury will receive instructions in 1707.1, and they will be told, among other things, that even if they find an intentional disregard of rights, and even if they find that there was malicious conduct, they don't have to award punitive damages. So this business that any volitional act, or drinking a cup of coffee, or driving 65 in a 55-mile-per-hour limit, or I think they suggest even parking in a no-parking zone, is absurd. It's nonsense. There still has to be the same analysis that I've just described, where the court will go through this process, and if they find the kind of conduct which warrants punishment or deterrence, then they will go on and proceed to decide whether it can go to the jury.
So how does that... You had your opening statement that the legislature wanted to limit punitive damages. Tell me how that limits punitive damages if we take the explanation that you just gave us, because having been a trial judge, I can envision that in many, many negligence cases there would be a, quote, claim for punitive damages. And then you're saying that I, as a trial judge, would then evaluate it, but then the jury would be given the instruction. Well, isn't that to get me to the jury on time type? In other words, won't many, many, many other cases be considered as ripe for punitive damages?
As you probably know, Justice Wilcox, in Brown versus Maxey, the court observed that very few negligence cases result in punitive damages. For example, one case that comes to mind is the Franz case, where this guy rendered another car at 85 miles an hour. That resulted in punitive damages. Brown versus Maxey is an example where punitive damages because of the outrageous conduct. But you, as a trial judge, you're the gatekeeper. And you're going to have to analyze the conduct and decide whether there was, in fact, intentional disregard of rights. Now, what's the difference between reckless disregard of rights and intentional disregard of rights? It's, as Justice Potter said when defining pornography, you'll know it when you see it. It's a more deliberate conduct. It's a more purposeful conduct. It's conduct where the actor is aware that his conduct has consequences of potential harm and proceeds nonetheless with those consequences and intentionally proceeds. So it's more than negligence. It's more than reckless. So some of the cases that perhaps would have qualified in the common law won't qualify anymore. And it'll be up to the judge to make that decision. But as I pointed out, the jury can still say no. That's the ultimate safeguard even before it gets to an appellate level. Let me point out a couple things, though. Although we believe that the plain language of this statute should govern, and it certainly doesn't say what the Court of Appeals says it says, there's a canon of statutory construction which says a court, when interpreting a statute, will not read extra words into a statute to achieve a specific right. Result, rather. A court, when interpreting a statute, will not read extra words into a statute to achieve a specific result. I think that's what happened here in the Court of Appeals. Now, the legislators, members of the court, they knew how to use the word intentional tort. And the legislature knew how to use the words intent to injure. In 1987, Senate Bill 330, Wisconsin Statute 89575, entitled Standards for Award of Punitive Damages, the statute stated you could only get punitive damages in intentional torts. They used those words. Now, that statute was not enacted. But there was another statute enacted in the same session that 89585 was enacted, which covered contact sports.
Counselor, can I interrupt you just a minute?
Sure.
I agree with you that there was an intent in the change in the legislation to eliminate recklessness as what one could prove and have the opportunity for punitive damages. And certainly that's what many trial lawyers did because it was always the easiest one to do. What about this case? What in the facts of this case go beyond reckless?
What did you say, ma'am?
What facts of this case go beyond reckless?
Okay. In this case, the person who ordered the lift in high winds was aware, the jury was entitled to find that he was aware of the fact that the winds were far in excess of that which the design of the crane itself was able to withstand, let alone with a lift piece that was half the size of a football field. And that he consciously made the decision that despite this potential for harm, which he described in his own testimony, there was a probability of tragedy in lifting a piece this big, if there were no wind calculations, which he knew there weren't, and a piece the size this big, and that people could be killed. He went ahead and he made this lift intentionally disregarding the rights of the workers and in particular the rights of the deceased plaintiffs. This was an intentional decision. It was a deliberate decision. It wasn't negligence. It wasn't that he fell asleep in the trailer. It wasn't that he went out for a walk and then forgot to come back.
Wasn't he standing underneath in the way of harm himself during the course of the lift?
Well, it's alleged that he was, but he wasn't in harm's way like the plaintiffs were or other members of the crew. He was away from the site. But nonetheless, if he chose to put himself at risk, that doesn't mean he has the right to put other people at risk as well. And his conduct was described by world-renowned crane expert as the most callous and outrageous conduct in disregard of workers' safety that this man in 30 years had ever seen. That's how bad this behavior was of the person who ordered the lift, and the jury found that there was intentional disregard of rights. And although there is, of course, the noble review, some credit has to be given to the findings of the jury on facts and with respect to what evidence supported the jury's finding of intentional disregard. But we don't have to guess about what the legislature intended. In addition to this contact sport thing, which I was about to talk about, the legislature allowed claims in contact sports only for claims which were based upon intent to injure, as well as recklessness. Now, they know how to use the words. They didn't use the words. And the same sponsor of that Bill 330 was the sponsor of 89585, Senator Leah. He knew what to say. But here's the best proof, and it was alluded to this morning. Representative Green, who is one of the chief sponsors of 89585-3, was asked what happens if an intoxicated doctor cuts off the wrong leg. He was asked that by a colleague. And here's what he said, quote, "You don't have to have an intent to the act took place. You have to prove malicious or intentional disregard of plaintiff's rights, not action being intended, but disregard of rights." Out of his mouth, came your answer, one of the chief sponsors of this particular bill. Another canon of construction. The court presumes that a legislature says in a statute what it means and means in a statute what it says. That was stated in Kalau. What about the instruction committee? Learned people? They looked at 895.85.3. They borrowed some words from 939.23. They borrowed purpose. They borrowed result. And they borrowed practical certainty. But what did they come up with? Did they interpret 895.85.3 as requiring intent to injure, intent to harm? No. Their 1707.1 states, a person acts in intentional disregard of the rights of the plaintiff if the person acts with a purpose to disregard the plaintiff's rights, or is aware that his or her acts are practically certain to result in plaintiff's rights being disregarded. Look at the cases decided subsequent to 895.85.3. Although the question of the interpretation of 895.85.3 never came up, none of those cases suggested that the interpretation placed on that statute required intent to injure. Now, all those cases, which were bad faith cases, required a sufficiency of evidence analysis. Now, don't you think that some bright lawyer, in arguing sufficiency of evidence, might have suggested that it was insufficient evidence because the statute required intent to injure or intent to harm? I suggest it wasn't done because that particular interpretation is so far-fetched. Now, I think the court should also, and this was mentioned this morning, I think by Justice Bradley, should also consider what serious consequences can result if the Court of Appeals interpretation prevails. Aggravated conduct in negligent cases will not warrant punitive damages, no matter how aggravated it is. Aggravated conduct in products liability cases will not warrant punitive damages, no matter how aggravated it is. And if you throw Boozma on top of it, then there won't be any case, even like the case that Justice Bradley referred to, where they knew that the harm was practically certain to occur. Aggravated conduct in drunk driving cases will not permit punitive damages if their interpretation prevails. If the drunk is even sober enough to form an intent, there is no practical certainty that when he goes out driving drunk, A, he's going to get caught, B, he's going to be in an accident in which there's injury.
Counselor, is the intent that's required in the statute to be proved subjectively, or is it an objective burden?
Both.
You want to explain that?
Yeah, sure. If you look at 1707.1, the instruction which I just alluded to, the person acts in intent to disregard of the rights of the plaintiff. The person acts with a purpose to disregard the plaintiff's rights. That's subjective. Or, let's assume it says, I didn't intend that. Or the court looks at the evidence and can infer that his or her acts are practically certain to result in plaintiff's rights being disregarded. That can be inferred by the court as a matter of law, no matter what the subjective intent may be. So it's both. It has objective and subjective intent. Now, and I also suggest
I just interrupt also while we're talking about intent?
Yeah.
I guess I'm troubled by the fact that the jury instructions committee looked to the criminal law to define intent, and I gathered from your comments you weren't satisfied that that was appropriate either. Where do you think we should look to define intent?
Where do I think you should look to find whether there was intent to disregard of rights?
Right. Looking at the word intent itself, the intentional disregard.
So I think, the intent is when an actor has a purpose to cause a result. Okay? That's the criminal law intent. And what they did is they engrafted that purpose and that practical certainty words from the criminal statute onto 1707.1. So what you're looking for, did the actor have a purpose to cause a result? And what is the result? Intentional disregard of rights. It's an intentional, it's deliberate. Just like our case, this man knew that these three men, 350 feet above the ground in the shadow of Big Blue, were in harm's way if that crane went down. He knew that that crane was in danger of going down. He admitted it himself that there was a probability if wind calculations hadn't been done, and if winds were in excess of the design specifications of the crane, which it was. So this was a purposeful act on his part. The expert I referred to a few minutes ago described it as he was playing Russian roulette with other people's lives.
Was there anything in the record to show that he knew, and I'm talking here about Mr. Groslich, so that's who I'm referring to, and I also might ask you about Mr. Noel, so either one.
Sure.
Knew either A, what the winds were, or B, what the load limit was for this particular equipment on the day it went down.
There is a mountain of evidence in this case which indicates what the wind speeds were that day.
That they knew. I'm talking about
their
knowledge.
Yes. Safety Supervisor Noel reported that he was holding a wind. He was holding, according to a witness, a wind speed indicator. He reported his concerns to Groslich, and you know what he said? He said that if Groslich was reported those wind speeds and went ahead with this lift, he was in conscious disregard of the worker's safety. There were admissions in this case by both Groslich and Noel with respect to, under the circumstances which the jury could find here, there was conscious disregard of worker's safety. So yes, there was abundant evidence.
Okay, so if I understand what you said, Noel was checking the wind speed during the lift, and he knew what the wind speed was,
and
he told it to Groslich, and Groslich acknowledges in the record...
No, he denies that he heard it. That was one of the... He denies that he got that information.
Did Noel say he told him during the lift?
He said he expressed his concerns. Noel even denied in the face of a witness that he was holding a handheld anemometer, a wind speed indicator. So there's lots of contradictory evidence in the record. But the jury was entitled to believe that both those gentlemen, in the mountain of evidence from other witnesses, knew what the wind speed was, proceeded with the lift notwithstanding, knew that this was a dangerous wind speed in respect to the size of the crane and the size of the piece, and they said, damn and torpedoes, full speed ahead, regardless of the danger that was obvious. And as I said a few moments ago, Groslich himself said, if you were to lift a piece as big as the roof piece lifted on July 14, 1999, in a wind of 26 miles an hour with 30-mile-an-hour gusts, which was in evidence from a number of witnesses, and there was no wind speed calculations done, which is the fact, and he knew they weren't done, he says, I dropped the ball. That's what he said, I dropped the ball. But he knew they weren't done. Then that would probably cause a tragedy by the crane falling over and killing people. That's in the record in our brief where we've cited that. I don't know how much more you have to prove that this man was aware of the risks and proceeded notwithstanding the risks. And the jury found, properly so, this was intentional disregard of rights. Now, punitive damages are still a remedy, as they were in the common law, as described by Brown versus Maxey. And someone asked me about conduct. If you look at the Wangen and Sharp cases, you'll see that disregard of rights is defined as conduct. Now, let me go in the last 20 minutes to the question of the constitutionality of the award, unless you have any further questions on the section statute.
You were here this morning on the oral argument.
Excuse me?
You were here this morning for the oral argument. Is your interpretation consistent with the plaintiffs in that case?
I would amplify it a bit, if I may. First of all, let me say to the court that unfortunately, this is a case that is unprecedented in Wisconsin for the degree of reprehensibility of the conduct of the wrongdoers, causing multiple deaths. In the list of 8 factors of reprehensibility of the conduct of wrongdoers and the sub-factors of aggravation in reprehensibility, which is set forth in BMW and in Campbell, all 8 were met in this case. Let me illustrate. Grievousness of the acts set forth in Trinity, yes. Disregard for safety and health, of others, BMW and Campbell, yes. Conduct causing personal injury, not mere economic harm, yes. Affirmative acts of misconduct, yes. Repeated misconduct set forth in BMW and Campbell, yes. Deliberate false statements, yes, set forth in BMW and Campbell. The targets were financially vulnerable, set forth in Campbell, yes. Concealment of evidence, yes, as a matter of fact. Destruction of evidence by the wrongdoers here. So all eight of those factors are present.
Mr. Haddish, in that regard, are you talking about the allegations of unplugging a computer?
Yes.
Was that ever established, or is that a contested?
That was established. That was established that Grotlich and one other employee were in the trailer while the dust was just being settled. The men were still lying on the ground. They rushed to the trailer, and he asked his associate to check the wind speeds. And mysteriously, sometime early that evening, the computer got unplugged, and the evidence of the wind speed that would have showed up on that computer disappeared. And when the police came the next day, they found out that this happened at 8:30 at night when they were in the trailer. So, what is the de novo review that the court has to make? Is $94 million, does it pass constitutional muster with a $5.25 million compensatory award?
Before you get into that, Mr. Haddish, I guess I have a question about that. I know the Travelers wanted us to deal with the constitutionality issue, and I think you joined in that request. As I understand the record, there were 19 issues that were briefed at the Court of Appeals. Do we have enough here to really reach the constitutionality issue?
Absolutely. And if the court chooses to refer to the Court of Appeal briefs with respect to those other issues, I know they're free to do so. And I would welcome this court to accept all the issues up here if they wish, and I would stand on our briefs on those issues if they feel that it's important to do so. Now, all cases agree the most important indicia of the reconsideration of the reasonableness of the punitive damage award is the degree of reprehensibility of the defendant's conduct. Professor David Owens, an expert on punitive damages, states, "The flagrancy of the misconduct is thought to be the primary consideration in determining the amount of punitive damages." That was cited in BMW in the Villanova Law Review. Third, all cases, United States Supreme Court and Wisconsin Supreme Court, agree economic loss should be viewed differently than loss of life or injury. As Justice Sykes noted in Trinity, no one was physically injured. No one's health or safety was at risk. There was no intentional deceit. Well, there was here, and there were three deaths. As noted earlier, there was plenty of deceit, repeated misconduct, intentional conduct, grievous acts, false statements, destruction of evidence, financially vulnerable targets, and unrepentant conduct that after three men had died, this same director, the site superintendent, tried to get the successor crane supervisor to raise the allowable speed limits so he could lift in higher speeds again. Unrepentant behavior that he obviously hadn't learned his lesson. So is there a bright line or not? Do we start with a fixed ratio above which we can never exceed, regardless of the aggravated nature of the conduct, the extent of the harm caused, or the nature of the harm? I don't think so. Cases, including Campbell, seem to say there's no bright line, or, as I would put it, one size does not fit all. Although Campbell seems to say that single-digit ratios are more likely to be sustained, and they add that 4-1 is better than 9-1, Campbell did say, quote, "The precise award in any case, of course, must be based upon the facts and circumstances of the defendant's conduct and harm to the plaintiff." BMW said, and I quote, "Some wrongs are more blameworthy than others, and the award should reflect the egregiousness of the conduct." In a recent case in Mathias versus Acor Economy Lodging in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, Judge Posner stated, "The Supreme Court in Campbell did not, however, lay down a 4-1 or single-digit rule." Now, when we look at harm, is it limited to the jury's award of compensatory damages? and is potential harm limited to the target of the conduct? All the cases say harm includes actual harm, and potential harm are factors to consider in the disparity analysis. Actual harm language is clearly set forth in BMW and Campbell, and they don't say disparity between the compensatory damage award and the punitive damage award. They say the disparity between the actual harm and the punitive damage award. And the same reference is made in Trinity between, I quote, the disparity between the harm suffered and the punitive damage award. They don't talk about harm award. They talk about the harm suffered.
Counsel, on yes, that sir. Point, I'd like to ask a question also. It's my understanding that the other side in this case would say you can't use $5.25 million when you're considering ratio, that you should look at $4.25 million, that you shouldn't include loss of society and companionship. What is your reason for arguing that we can indeed look at loss of society and companionship?
Well, actually, in the summary I saw printed by the Supreme Court this morning, they did refer to 18-1, which includes the 5.25.
No, but we're not bound by the summary that the
you're not bound by the
PR
question.
Folks put out.
good try, though. I found a real pearl, but I didn't. All right. In any event, whether you take 22-1 or 18-1, it's really kind of moot, Justice Crooks, and because actual harm should be considered, not the actual award. And what is actual harm in this case? The law society was capped at $350,000 per widow. Now, these were young women with good marriages, and I don't think I have to argue too eloquently that the law society exceeded $350,000. So that was the actual harm. Children suffered actual harm. They were not allowed to collect under the wrongful death statute. The lost future income was not submitted to the jury. The horror suffered by these men falling 250 to their feet to their death, knowing they were going to die, could well have exceeded the award that was made by the jury. And finally, there was a $12,375,000 settlement, which could well be argued reflects the defendant's evaluation of what the compensatory damages could be and suggested they were concerned that it would even be more than that. Now, in Trinity, as you well know, Justice Crooks, $490,000 settlement was taken into consideration in determining the ratio to make 7-1. There was only actual damage of $17,000. If you use that, the ratio was 205-1. So I'm suggesting there's other factors here other than the award that the jury makes. Now, what about potential harm? Is it limited to the target? Can we consider that there were seven men very close to being killed as well, including the crane operator who was holding the deceased aloft? We think you can. And if you look at the language of TXO and the language of Hazlitt, both U.S. Supreme Court cases, TXO says other victims that might have resulted in their language. Hazlitt talks about the relationship between punitive damage awards and the harm likely to result from the defendant's conduct, as well as the harm that actually occurred. So they're talking about other potential victims other than the target of the conduct in that language. And BMW, when they were talking about why the award was not sustainable, says that there was no evidence any other purchasers of BMWs were threatened with an additional harm by BMW's non-disclosure policy. So they're talking about potential victims other than the specific target. And here, as I said, it was a miracle that more than three of those workers were not killed. And this should be factored into the potential harm consideration in evaluating the award. With respect to notice, the size of this construction site, the dangers associated with it, clearly gave MHIA notice that tragedy can occur if misconduct occurs. But more importantly, there was $102 million of insurance coverage for liability, which did not exclude punitive damage coverage. That alone indicates the enormous potential harm that could incur on this job site, which is more than sufficient notice. MHIA is a national firm. It has offices in 12 locations. It's a subsidiary of an international conglomerate. They know about various awards around the country, so I don't think they can hide behind any argument that they did not realize what the potential for a compensatory or punitive damage award could be. Now, with respect to prior and subsequent conduct, let me state this. Campbell says that similar conduct can be relevant on the issue of reprehensibility. That's talked about, Haslip talks about similar past conduct with respect to one of their factors. TXO talks about pattern of trickery. In Wisconsin, Anello, Musek, Livero, Smith versus Golding all stand for the relevancy of prior acts of conduct on the issue of punitive damages. The prior conduct in Campbell was dissimilar to the kind of conduct that affected the Campbells, which is a third-party settlement situation. There was conduct in states around the country, some of which was lawful, some of which was just talked about the bad acts of State Farm and how they handled claims or how they dealt with people. They were clearly dissimilar, and Campbell was correct there. But in our case, the conduct before July 14th all related to what? Disregard of safety of the workers. Whether it was going up on prior lifts in dangerous conditions, whether it was disregarding complaints of workers about safety, whether it was using coercion to get an employee of Lamson thrown off the job site because he complained of safety, all those things are similar to the type of conduct which caused that crane to go down on July 14th. Now, what about the conduct subsequent to the injury? As we talked about, destruction of evidence. Would that not be relevant to the conduct as one of the factors of whether repentance occurred, whether deterrence is needed? How about talking to the subsequent crane supervisor that he should raise the speed limits? What does that tell us? They don't get it. They haven't learned their lesson. Does that cry out for deterrence? I suggest it does, and it also is relevant. There's been a suggestion of one of the factors is wealth. Net worth statement was not introduced into evidence, but as Judge Posner said in Matthias, we note that net worth is not the correct measure of a corporation's resources. It is an accounting artifact that reflects the allocation of ownership between equity and debt claimants. And in Jones versus Fisher, a Wisconsin case in 5142, net worth is not the only measurement of wealth. And in Fairbury versus Tengel, this court has said, failure to show net worth does not invalidate the award of punitive damages, but eliminates one factor by which the reasonableness of an award can be gauged.
Counsel?
Yes.
With regard to amount, the standard of review is, it's a de novo standard of review. When I take a look at the factors that are set forth in BMW and State Farm and as set forth in the Trinity opinion, if I were doing a de novo review, and let's say you prevail on the first issue. Let's just assume that in my question. Should a de novo review of the factors set forth lead me to conclude that if and I'm going to assume punitive damages, I'm just addressing amount, $5 million is fine, $15 million is fine, $30 million is fine, $60 is fine, $84 is fine?
You know, Judge Justice Bradley, I've been around a long time, and I've had judges over the years have to decide questions of excessiveness and remitter, and I'm smart enough to know that it's a gut call. You know, either you're going to think it's too high, you think it's okay, you think it's too low, but all I got to say is that I doubt very much if you're going to see a fact situation that is so over the top as this case, where you have all eight factors of reprehensibility and aggravation exist and continued unrepentant conduct. So I think if anything pushes the upper limits of what you think is reasonable for punishment and deterrence, this is the case. I don't think you're ever going to see a case that cries out for punishment and deterrence more than this case. Now, I know that's self-serving, but just think about the factors that I have discussed with the court with respect to what influences you, and look at the actual damages, not just the damages that were supplied by the jury, and ask yourself if those were factored in, is this such an outrageous ratio? Do you know that this Mathias case I talked about, you know, it was about bedbugs. Bedbugs. And some motel didn't fumigate the motel. It was pretty reprehensible conduct, but the worst injury was bed bug bites. Now, I'm not saying that's pleasant, but Judge Posner observed that 37 to 1 was an appropriate ratio in that case. I think there was something like $191,000 in punitives and $5,000 or $6,000 in compensatory. So I know it's up to you folks. What you think is reasonable, we'll live with. But I just ask you to consider the facts of this case as to whether a slap on the wrist is enough or whether someone has to get hit on the side of the head by a 2x4 in order to get their attention. And I suggest in this case, they do. I have one final point. Every court has recognized economic losses shouldn't govern personal injury or death cases. Every case has observed that the same degree of reprehensibility does not occur in every case. But punitive damages have the effect of bringing to punishment the types of conduct that, although aggressive and hurtful to the individual, must invariably go unpunished by the public prosecutor. That's from Kink versus Combs. And in this case, it did go unpunished by the public prosecutor. And Wangen put it best. The need for punitive damages may be particularly appropriate in a product liability case because mere compensatory damages might be insufficient to deter the defendant from future wrongdoing. Members of the court, this flawed interpretation of 895.85.3 by the Court of Appeals, even though it's the interpretation is something that maybe they wanted and maybe other people want it to be, cannot withstand scrutiny and is nothing less than unacceptable legislating by the Court of Appeals majority. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Habish. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. We'll now hear from Attorney Ralph Weber, representing Mitsubishi.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Ralph Weber. I'm here for Mitsubishi Heavy Industries America. With us in court today are Mr. Yamamoto and Mr. Saito from MHIA. My 25 minutes will concentrate on the punitive damage statute, reinforcing the correctness of the Wisher result and the Wisher reasoning, as expressed by Judge Wiedemeyer. Mr. Bush's 20 minutes will follow up on the statute and several other issues unique to insurance companies. And Mr. Williamson's 15 minutes will concentrate on the constitutional excessiveness question. Let me first acknowledge that Mrs. Wisher's counsel spoke passionately about this tragic accident. MHIA joins in the expressions of grief, of respect, and of honor for these men. And insofar as dollars can compensate for these losses, then compensation was due and has been paid. But we're not here today about compensation. We're here today to discuss our legislature's decision in 1995 to change Wisconsin law. And in that discussion, passion and other emotions have no role to play. All parties to this appeal acknowledge the legislature's right to look at what had been judge-made law going back to 1854 and to reach its own and different and controlling policy conclusion about what the appropriate threshold for punitive damages is in Wisconsin courts. Thus, we consider dispassionately the legislative scope of 895-85 and then compare that to the scope of the facts admitted by the plaintiffs and found by the trial court. In that light, we see the Court of Appeals understood both the statute and the plain error of plaintiffs' position expressed today. Let's first start with what we know for certain. First, MHIA did not act with the intent to harm these men. Second, MHIA was not aware that these men were practically certain to be harmed. Third, NHIA's site manager, Mr. Grotlich, and the safety director, Mr. Noel, were themselves in harm's way, in the zone of danger, literally in the shadow of the crane when it broke and fell over. Mr. Noel had to run for his life. How do we know these things? Because the plaintiffs admitted these facts, and the trial court so found. What else do we know for certain? We know that the 1995 legislature made punitive damages less available than they have been under common law. And we know this because, again, the plaintiffs admit this policy change occurred. So let's discuss the statute and how these admissions preclude punitive damages in this case. There are three interpretations of 895-85 in front of the court today. You have the plaintiff's extreme view on one hand. You have the Hugner party's extreme view on the other. And then you have the Court of Appeals in Wisher and NHIA's view, which I submit is the correct view with the right result and the right reasoning.
Well, Mr. Weber, what does the statute say?
The statute has two subparts. Punitive damages, as decided by the legislature, are available in two separate instances. One, if the defendant acts maliciously toward the plaintiff, which has been admitted is not the case here, or two, acts in intentional disregard of the rights of the plaintiff. And of course, as we talked about this morning and again this afternoon, plaintiffs claim that an intentional disregard of rights of the plaintiff to a safe workplace makes them eligible for punitive damages even though there was no specific or general intent to injure. How do we...
What was changed from the common law approach? The statute merely take out recklessness? Isn't that what they did?
It changed the word reckless to intentional, yes.
And... All right, so it took out, no, I actually, because you had, as I understand it, willful and wanton, which I think is subsumed in intentional. It took out reckless. Isn't that what it did?
Yes, it did.
What else did the statute do?
It codified what the standard was so that as opposed to a multifactorial, you know it when you see it sort of analysis urged by the trial courts and what the trial courts did in the past, it set forth the standards that are to be applied. Now, we need to focus quite specifically, I think, on exactly what the plaintiffs are claiming the intent of the meaning of the statute is. And I'd refer the court to page 6 of their reply brief. Plaintiffs say the result of the intent, and this has been a question that's come up many times today, the result of the intent to which 895-85-3 refers is the disregard of rights, not an injury. That's the reply brief at 6, note 6. And elsewhere on page 6, they say, the result or consequence which must be intentional is the disregard of rights. Okay? Now, this
Mr.
leads
Weber,
to...
isn't that consistent with the statute? I mean, that's what the statute says, doesn't it?
The statute says that, yes, and it's predicated upon common law reading of that expression that if you read it without reference to the understanding of those terms in the common law makes no sense in light of what has been agreed the legislature was trying to do. Because if you read it without reference to the common law meaning of that phrase, disregard of rights, you get to absurd results, where punitive damages would be available in simple negligence cases and in cases where under the common law the punitive damages had been denied.
Where does the statute say intention to harm these men or practically certain to be harmed? Where does the statute say that?
The common law cases on which that language, disregard of rights, is based make that quite plain, going back to Kink v. Combs, Brown v. Maxey, Sharp, all these cases. If you go back and look, what's happening is they are talking about the defendant's state of mind with respect to a particular outcome. And they talk about the injury and the disregard of rights interchangeably. And the reason it's written in terms of disregard of rights and not, for example, personal injury, is it This statute covers more than personal injury cases. It covers defamation cases, other economic loss cases. So it wouldn't make sense, unless that's what the legislature wanted to do, to limit it simply to that class of cases. This Court has repeatedly said they're not going to take a classification approach, and I don't believe the legislature did either. But let me give you an example, building off of what the plaintiffs have said on page 6 that I think brings the point home. Imagine that Aunt Millie is driving a child to soccer game. She's late, so she exceeds the speed limit. Unfortunately, she causes an accident. Her conduct is intentional, volitional, and by exceeding the speed limit, she is disregarding her fellow driver's right to a safe highway. Under plaintiff's standard, the injured party could receive punitive damages, even though no one could say Aunt Millie was aware an accident was practically certain to occur due to her speed.
How fast was she driving?
65 in a 55.
How many children were present?
3.
So how can you say she didn't know or wasn't aware of the dangers?
The road was empty. She saw no other cars.
That's my question.
Yes.
You're putting in those facts that the road was empty and she saw no other cars.
Right. But as soon as she goes, I'm sorry.
But suppose she's in a school zone and there are children present all around, and there are other cars, double and triple parked, and she's exceeding her speed limit.
Your additional facts prove the very point I'm talking about.
Why?
Because you get into the head of the defendant and try to do an analysis of what outcome under the new standard was practically certain to occur under the old statute, recklessness. But it is not enough, as plaintiffs suggest, that as soon as you disregard the rights, as soon as you go 65 and a 55, you have disregarded the rights of your fellow travelers to a safe highway. And then if a tort occurs, boom, punitive damages are available. It's a metaphysical notion of punitive damages in the air as soon as you go beyond the speed limit, violate right to a safe workplace, with it only when the tort is finally culminated that the punitive damages are made real. That isn't the law, wasn't the law prior to 95, and can't be the law if we want to respect the legislative intent to make it harder to achieve punitive damages. It's also a nightmare for the trial courts. But let me apply the same approach to a prior decision of this court, the Loveridge case. In Loveridge, there was consensual sexual contact between an adult and a minor. The adult's cold sores transmitted herpes to the minor through oral sex. Now, the adult disregarded the minor's right, actually recognized in criminal law, not to have sex with an adult. But the court held no punitive damages. Why? Because although the adult acted intentionally in the sexual conduct, he did not, one, desire to transmit herpes, and two, and importantly, from his state of mind, was not aware the injury would follow from his conduct. The court further explained, and this is important going back to the hypothetical, and this is at page 176 of 161 with second. The court went on to explain, although the act was illegal, in this case, sexual relations with a minor, the illegality of the act does not equate to an intent to injure, noting that otherwise every violation of the speed limit would equate to an intent to injure. So it can't be the way they suggest the statute should be read, because if it were, every Wisconsin trial court would have to send punitives to every jury in, among other cases, every traffic case, every safe place claim, and every workplace injury where some volitional act can be described as having created an unsafe highway, workplace, or unsafe circumstances of any kind.
Does your interpretation, in effect, get rid of all punitive damages in products liability cases?
It does not.
Give me an example where it would not.
As in Wangen, the focus there was, what did Ford know with respect to its defective fuel tank system, and what did it understand the likely outcome was of failing to fix that tank? under that statute, under that former variation, be reckless or outrageous as a catchphrase. Under the new statute, you would have to show that the manufacturer either intended to cause harm or was practically certain that harm would follow. And in doing that, you'd look at the defendant's state of mind, the subjective intent, either directly or through circumstantial evidence as to what that subjective intent was.
So it doesn't have to be this plaintiff, any plaintiff.
I believe that's correct, yes. I don't see that the legislature intended to exclude product liability cases from the reach of the statute, but that really isn't part of our case.
Were you here for the arguments this morning, counsel?
I was, yes.
Then you would not be in concert with defense counsel from this morning's argument with regard to the interpretation of the statute vis-a-vis the word the plaintiff. Is that correct?
That's correct. As I said, I think the court has three options in front of it: an extreme view by the plaintiffs this morning and this afternoon, an extreme view by Hogner's counsel, and the Court of Appeals decision in Wisher and MHI's position, which both recognizes the common law and gives appropriate recognition to the legislative intent.
Just so I'm sure, why don't you state for me what you view as the plaintiff's extreme view, Hogner's extreme view,
right,
and the porridge that's just right in the middle.
Okay. Plaintiff's I'm sorry? All right.
I said the porridge that's just right in the middle. Your view.
Oh, right. Plaintiff's extreme view is set forth on page 6 of their reply brief, in footnote 6 and in the body, which says all you have to do is act intentionally, yes, but intentionally to do what? Simply to disregard the right. So you disregard the right to work to highway safety when you speed. You disregard the right to workplace safety if you do certain things. You disregard the right to a safe grocery store if you leave a puddle on the floor. So they're saying that's enough to make you eligible for punitives. Then, if a injury occurs, punitives follow or would have to be sent to the jury. So it would be a nightmare for Wisconsin trial courts, because in each case, they would have to send these to the jury. And it would not, it would not be the case, as was suggested, that the trial court would act as this filter, because it's not the common law standard anymore where the trial judge applied these factors. There is now a statutory standard that the trial judge applies, albeit it is based in part on the common law tradition and holdings.
The common law indicates, though, that in order for there to be punitive, the conduct must be more than just negligence. And so doesn't that address your argument that everything would be available in an ordinary negligence case?
Well, I agree with your point. In weighing in, they say simple negligence isn't enough. But if you adopt plaintiff's approach, you'd have to rewrite Wangen, because every negligence case involves the breach of a duty. And as long as there's a volitional act, not sleepwalking or a seizure or a sneeze or something, you're going to have an intentional act that disregards a duty.
What about, Wangen has been around for quite some while, something of a little more recent vintage, the Levro case, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, where it states in order for conduct to be outrageous, there must be aggravating circumstances beyond ordinary negligence.
Right. Well, the aggravating circumstances, outrageous conduct, those really are conclusions or catchphrases to describe the multi-factor analysis that was provided. And importantly, in Levro, remember, in that case, they ultimately decided that there was insufficient evidence under the middle burden to show that there was any impairment that led to the accident. That's why they were talking about the left-hand turn this morning. So Levro fits exactly within what I'm talking about. And remember, in Levro, there was some fairly serious prior conduct, including the death of a child in a prior drunk driving case. But in that case, Judge Fine and the District Court, or the Court of Appeals, said no punitive. So Levro fits exactly within what I'm talking about.
Levro, if I may just follow up. Thank you. Liberal also goes on to say that there's a distinction here. Conduct, and I'm reading from page 345, conduct justifying an award of punitive damages can take two forms. Number one, if the defendant intends to cause the harm. Or number two, if the harm is the result of a reckless or conscious disregard of the rights of others, citing the Brown case. It seems to me that your interpretation says, no, they're not those two, but rather they are one in the same, and yet both Brown and Levereau seem to suggest otherwise. Right. How do you respond?
They're not one in the same. Under the statute, you have, remember, and we can't lose sight of it, the first part of 895, which is acts maliciously toward the plaintiff. And that picks up many cases where I think your gut would tell you, you know what, we want punitives to apply here. Hate crimes, particularly egregious defamation cases. Those things can get picked up under Part 1 of the statute. Part 2 of the subpart, though, does require practical certainty of the outcome. That's the difference between the recklessness standard and the intentional standard. And as you look at, like, for example, Brown, if you go back and look at the context of the phrase disregard of rights in those cases, yes, those words appear, but you have to understand them in context. So, for example, in Kink v. Combs, they talk about disregard of rights, and then in the very next sentence, they talk about the sexual assault that this woman was subjected to. In Wangen, they talk about in Sharp, they talk about disregard of rights, but it's in the context of the terrible injuries that were caused by the PTO. In Brown, they say specifically, in Brown, we have to evaluate what was in the mind of Dr. Maxey with respect to the probability of future injuries. Again, in that case, recklessness. Now it would be practical certainty. So in each of these cases, they're saying we have to evaluate this conduct from the standpoint of the defendant and decide whether they were aware that certain results were practically certain. And in this case, they've admitted that Mitsubishi was not so aware.
Can you just focus on, as we all are, the definition of intentional disregard of the rights of the plaintiff? That's what the statute says.
Yes.
In a sentence, what does this mean, intentional disregard of the rights of the plaintiff?
It means that the person acts intentionally with specific or inferred intent to with the awareness that a tortious injury is practically certain to occur.
Isn't that the same as intends to cause harm?
You mean the first subpart?
Well, the first subpart, and in fact, I hear some duplication, so I need help with that.
I understand that.
The first subpart says acted maliciously toward the plaintiff.
Yes.
And it seems like none of us are really talking about acting maliciously toward the plaintiff. So that's out of here. What we're focusing on, intentional disregard of the rights of the plaintiff. And I hear your definition of that to be intent to cause harm to the plaintiff. That's what I hear your definition of that sentence to be, or that phrase to be.
It is act either with specific or inferred intent, with an awareness that a tortious injury is practically certain to follow.
And where is that in the statute?
It's the two-step process we talked about earlier of going from reckless, which would be probability of injury, to intentional, practical certainty, based on the common law usage of disregard of rights. And as you go back to Loveridge and Brown and Wangen and Sharp and Liveroe, disregard of rights is always tied back to the particular tortious injury they're talking about, whether it was the fires or the amputation, the sexual assault. It always gets tied back to the tort that brings you here, not general notions of disregard of rights of workplace safety or that sort of thing.
But don't you have here an intent, the language of the legislature, an intent that the intentional act that was changed from reckless.
Yes.
To disregard that the act, the modifier, the intent modifies, that results in an injury. It seems like you want to take out the disregard and go right to injury.
No, I don't. Disregard of rights has to be understood in two respects. One, the common law consistent usage of that phrase, and secondly, against the admitted and agreed legislative plan to make punitives less common. If you, the only way to tie those two together is to read the statute as the Wisher appellate court did, and as we're urging here, in between those two extremes. Now sorry.
I want to ask you a little bit about the conduct that's alleged to be repetitive, and I'm most interested in that conduct that occurred before the tragic accident in July. And I want you to talk to me a little bit about whether punitive damages are appropriately based on conduct that itself did not cause an injury.
No, I think that this Court's decision in Keel, the fleeing the scene of the accident case, makes quite plain that the conduct complained of to try to meet that statutory standard to get punitives has to be tied to the injury complained of. In that case, a person fled the scene, and the Court said, while that disregarded rights, perhaps, it wasn't related to the injury in issue. And if I could follow up on a few of your other points, because I think...
So just a sec. There are other cases that talk about this conduct that occurs before the accident as being relevant to intent. And if they're relevant to intent, then why aren't they relevant to punitive damages?
Well, I guess I could see them relevant in a hypothetical case where you're trying to understand through circumstantial evidence what the intent was of the actor in issue. But in this case, again, we have plain and repeated admissions from the plaintiffs that Mitsubishi was not aware that an accident and injuries were practically certain to occur. And some of the statements that were made about the facts I'd like to correct because they're just not right. With respect to the wind sail calculations, please look at the testimony of October 23rd, 2000 at page 119, and it makes it quite clear that Mr. Grotlich said he thought Lampson had done the wind sail calculations. He never said he knew wind sail calculations were not made. He said if they were not made, danger could result, but he thought they had been, and he said he dropped the ball in not following up to make sure Lampson, the world leader in safe in large lifts that they hired, had done what he thought their job was to do. Secondly, Justice Crooks asks about the computer and the wind sail calculations. It is absolutely not settled that Mr. Grotlich unplugged it. To the contrary, and please, I refer you to our supplemental brief at page 15, note 53, which includes testimony at appendix 32 to 34 and 38, again from October 23rd, 2000, and I believe the record site is 727. So that characterization of what the facts were at trial, I absolutely disagree with. In closing, plaintiffs spent a long time talking about the policy, why punitive damages are important, and essentially a jury argument about why they should be awarded here. We're not here today to decide policy on punitive damages. The legislature did that. We're not here today over disputed facts. Plaintiffs admitted MHIA did not know injury was practically certain. So not policy, not passion, but law. And of the three views of the law before the court today, the view expressed in the Wisher Court of Appeals decision and amplified today, is the only one that honors both the legislation, the common law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. We are going to take a moment or so before you start, Mr. Bush, so that the marshal can change the disc, because as you know, we're recording this. our waiting for the disc has been interpreted as a moment of silence taken by the court in all these cases. I might.
Wisdom.
Yeah.
I'm not warm.
Tell the jury they can take a stretch break.
That's right. I think we're ready. John A. Bush, attorney representing Federal Insurance Company.
Correct, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is John A. Bush. I represent the Federal Insurance Company. I'm going to spend my time primarily, in light of the discussions that went on this morning and this afternoon, concentrating on the term intentional disregard of rights. And I announce in advance that my position, and what the position I believe is the correct interpretation, is identical to that advanced by MHIA, is in support of the Court of Appeals, is not what the plaintiff says, and is not what the defendant said in Strenke. And Justice Butler, the guidelines that I'm going to use in regard to my interpretation, I think are very simple. They are contained at 990.01.1. And they say that a phrase that has a peculiar meaning in the law shall be construed according to that meaning. And ladies and gentlemen, there is no word in the jurisprudence of punitive damages that's been more construed than the term in the disregard of the rights of the plaintiffs. That has been part of our jurisprudence since well before 1995. And if one were to look at 1707, the pre-1995, it says that a person's conduct is outrageous, and we'll talk about how that's been eliminated, if the person acts either maliciously or in wanton, willful, or reckless disregard of the plaintiff's rights. It's been around forever. And indeed, if you want a definition, which we've all been struggling for a definition of a person's conduct, if it's an intentional disregard or a reckless disregard, we'll call it disregard of the rights to start out with. I direct the Court's attention to page 21 of the Sharp case. A person's conduct is wanton, willful, and in reckless disregard of the plaintiff's rights when it demonstrates an indifference on the person's part to the consequences of his or her actions, even though he or she may not intend insult or injury. That's what it was under the common law. What has happened? Recklessness is taken out. And what has occurred is the standard has gone up to intent, both objective and subjective intent. So I would suggest that
Mr. Bush, isn't part of what's going on here and part of the difficulty the Court's having that the legislature tried to combine two terms that don't easily combine?
I don't think so. I think what happened here was that the legislature took what courts have construed forever, which is the disregard of rights, took out reckless, wanton, and willful and put in intentional. And I can't imagine they thought that there was going to be that much hullabaloo that arose out of it, because all they intended to do was to get rid of the very word that Mr. Habish repeated four times. Remember what he said? He said it was probable. Probable is recklessness. Probable, substantial probability, and all you got to do is go to Brown v. Maxey, probability is recklessness. Practical certainty is intent. And he's the one who said it four times. He's the one who admitted it, that there was no evidence of practical certainty. He's the one who admitted that there was no evidence of intent. And that's what I want to talk about right now. Because if you look at that, the key here is that we focus on the consequences of his or her actions. And that's exactly what the Court of Appeals said. It said, intentional disregard of the plaintiff's rights requires proof of intent to cause injury or an awareness that the conduct was practically certain to cause the accident. Let's stop there for a moment. It's not, we don't take the position that it's towards any particular plaintiff. What we're talking about here is that there is practical certainty to cause the accident. The Court of Appeals got it right, and it got it right for at least two reasons. One, it did raise the standard, as I just stated, from probability to practical certainty. But more importantly, it paid homage to what the trial courts in this state have had to deal with from the beginning of time with regard to punitive damages. And it's right in Wisconsin Civil Jury Instruction 1707-1 and was in before 1995. And I want to read you what it says. If evidence is presented regarding conduct by the defendant that is unrelated to the defendant's conduct causing the plaintiff's injuries, consider giving the following instruction. Quote, the conduct for which you find punitive damages should be assessed must have caused or contributed to the plaintiff's injuries. This is a quote. Case law supports the concept that the jury, in answering the punitive special damage verdict, must focus on the acts causing the injuries for which the compensatory damages were assessed. What does this...
Yes. I could stop you right there, because that's kind of where I'm stuck. The intent of the legislature was to raise the standard of care. That goes to the conduct. Then you add causing the injury. Aren't we talking about two different things here?
I don't think so. I think because as has been the case all along, the disregard of the rights of the plaintiff in the context of this is the conduct must have caused or contributed to plaintiff's injuries. And what they took out was recklessness, and they put in intent. And this is where, and I want to direct the court's attention to the rather long definition of what the new law would be under the plaintiff's theory. And that goes to page 34 of their brief. But in particular, I want you to listen to the following, what they suggest. That under the new standard that they suggest, quote, you could have punitive damages without the necessity of having to prove actual intent or practical certainty to cause the consequences that ensue from the disregard of the rights. How does that square under any set of circumstances with the common law of this state, which says that in answering the jury questions, that must focus on the acts causing the injuries? He wants to divorce the consequences from the injuries. This construction is contrary to established law and invites juries to, quote, roam the caverns of their consciousness to punish conduct they deem despicable without the need for plaintiffs to prove he or she suffered some actual damage as a result of the conduct.
Does, I guess everybody agrees reckless is gone. Do you think that intentional replaces willful and wanton, and what's the difference?
I do believe that intentional replaces wanton, and I believe that Justice Crooks, I do believe that the legislature intended to engraft the definition of intentional that's in the criminal statute. I mean, I think, and that encompasses both the idea of actual intent, and I believe the term is practical certainty, knowledge or awareness of practical certainty. The problem that we have with the old terms, they got mixed up. The malice, I think, is a separate animal
But what about willful and wanton?
Willful and wanton, they got hooked up with reckless. And I think that...
Bad company, huh?
I think they were in company. I think they went everywhere together, and I think that was one of the problems that the court had. Because the real analysis of the level of conduct is contained in Brown v. Maxey, which, contrary to what opposing counsel says, supports our position. And that's where in Brown v. Maxey the court went through this long discussion about what is willful, wanton, and reckless. And it came to the conclusion that that's the level of conduct where it is substantially probable. That's the words that are in the recklessness standards, and those were used, I believe, four times by Mr. Habish. What it also says is there's another level, and that's the level of practical certainty. And that's where we are now. We're living in the world of practical certainty. And what's the one thing we know in this case? The one thing we know in this case, from the beginning to the end, the concessions and the findings of the trial court, is that there was no evidence, I repeat, no evidence of any practical certainty to cause the injury. And that's what was needed in order to get punitive damages in this case. It is not there. I'm not the person who used the word probable. I'm not the person who quoted the language from Mr. Gralich that talked about probability. That was Mr. Habish. Probability is out when it comes to punitive damages in this state.
Counselor, could I ask you one question that's kind of bugging me, and I think it's bothering Justice Butler just a bit. If you read the Court of Appeals opinion in this case, and I look at paragraph 5 for that, looking at the second part of the statute, which is really all we're focused on today, they talk about practical certainty, let's see, or knowledge, that the defendant's conduct was practically certain to cause, and I focus on to cause, the accident or injury to the plaintiffs. But if you look at the jury instructions, it says, is aware that his acts are practically certain to result in. Okay, so result in is in the jury instructions. Cause is in the opinion. I find a difference. Do you find a difference, or am I worrying about something I shouldn't be worrying about?
Well, I think in the normal garden variety case, those two would be the same. But that's why when you have evidence of unrelated bad acts, evidence of acts that may be as bad as they can be, like in Loveridge, you have evidence of a man who consciously committed and violated the criminal law in having sex with a minor, that where that comes in, just as here, there may be evidence of a violation of a right to safety. If it isn't causative, and if they can't link that cause, then that's why this corrective instruction comes in, which says the conduct for which you find punitive damages should be assessed must have caused or contributed to the plaintiff's injuries. And that's why the suggestion in the plaintiff's brief, and as they advocate, that you can have punitive damages unrelated to the cause, the act, the conduct that caused the injuries, is very problematic. I mean, I'll repeat what he has to say. You can have punitive damages without the necessity of having to prove actual intent or practical certainty, which is what I think we're talking about now, to cause the consequences that ensue from the disregard of rights. That is absolutely contrary to the jurisprudence of this state, and as I stated before, I think opens up the world to a whole host of unrelated conduct. And there's another problem with that.
Counsel, before you get to that other problem, so keep that right here, Brown versus Maxey, maybe I'm misreading it, but with regard to probability and the point that you just made, it describes on page 433 the different types of conduct warranting punitive damages. It says the first type, the plaintiff desires to cause the harm sustained by the plaintiff or believes that the harm is substantially certain to follow his conduct. Now I get to my point. With the second type of conduct, the defendant knows or should have reason to know not only that his conduct creates an unreasonable risk of harm, but also that there is a strong probability, although not a substantial certainty, that the harm will result, but nevertheless he proceeds with his conduct in reckless or conscious disregard of the consequences.
Yes, that's the old law.
Okay.
And the old law, and the operative word there is the second type of conduct knows, and that's intent, or should have reason to know. And should have reason to know is probability, and that's out. Now, when I say no, it doesn't mean actual knowledge. It's not limited to actual knowledge. It also includes the practical certainty, awareness of the practical certainty that it will occur.
You say to me, that's the old law. Other than the date, which is, you know, precedes 1995, why is it not applicable to the interpretation of the disregard of the rights of the plaintiff?
Well, because I think should have reason to know, I think, is recklessness. That's how I interpret it, and it gets consistent with what's in here.
And I'm emphasizing the probability, because you're talking about there's no probability in our jurisprudence, and that's why...
Not any longer. I mean, substantial probability was recklessness, and practical certainty is knowledge or intent. That was my point.
I think that, let me make this. You say that the intentional disregard of plaintiff's rights continues the common law.
Yes.
And I think that the question being asked is, common law was just read to you. Why doesn't it apply here?
The common law with regard to the word disregard of the plaintiff's rights, the change is taking out wanton, willful, and reckless, taking out reckless, as it were, or, as I interpret it, the substantially certain, probability, should have reason to know. I believe that's out. And what they did was simply raise the bar from probability to practical certainty, but leaving the disregard of plaintiff's rights, which has been in there all along, and which we suggest by the definition I just read from Sharp, is an appreciation of the consequences of the action. And that's why if you divorce the consequences of the action from the intent, that's where you run afoul, I suggest, of our jurisprudence heretofore in regard to punitive damages. And equally problematic is, I believe, you run afoul of the United States Constitution. And in that regard, remember the State Farm v. Campbell case. In the State Farm v. Campbell case, the Utah State Courts ran afoul because they punished a defendant for conduct that did not harm the plaintiff. And they said that in order to be constitutionally subject to punishment, a defendant should be punished for the conduct that harmed the plaintiff, not for being an unsavory individual or business, and that the error was in failing to punish for the conduct that did the injury because it bore no relationship to the harm suffered by the plaintiff. That wasn't very accurate. I apologize. It wasn't eloquent. But it's right on this point, which is there cannot be, as suggested by the plaintiffs, a separation of the conduct that causes the harm from the conduct from the state of mind or the awareness. Because if you do, then I believe it's wrong under State Farm. And as I read all the cases, and Justice Butler, when I did the word search, I think you're going to find probably 50 cases that talk about in disregard of the plaintiff's rights. And all of them, the ones that where there is any suggestion, like in Loveridge, any suggestion that there's a distinction between the conduct causative of the harm and other conduct to be punished, that's where they come in right away and say, trial courts, remember, you got to punish for the conduct causing the injury. And the level of uncertainty in this state for the conduct causing has to be, the conduct causing injury has to be intentional. And what that means is that in our jurisprudence, it means that there must be practical certainty, awareness of the practical certainty that the harm will follow from your conduct. And that was missing in this case. And that's why the Court of Appeals did what it did. And the Court of Appeals didn't adopt Boomsma. And the Court of Appeals didn't put the plaintiff as being specific plaintiff. What they did was they gave fidelity to the common law, recognizing that the legislature had raised the level. With regard to excessiveness, I believe my colleague, Mr. Williamson, will address that. I'll only state the following, and that is that when we look at State Farm, and particularly its quotation of Haslip, says that in upholding a punitive damage award in Haslip, they concluded that an award of four times the amount of compensatory might be close to the line of constitution. I know there's not a bright line, but ladies and gentlemen, there was a substantial reward that was awarded by the jury in this case. I mean, it's a tragedy. No one can do anything other than acknowledge that tragedy, but it was a substantial award. It was an award, and with regard to the decision whether or not to go for economic damages, that was a decision made by the plaintiff. He chose to put in the pain and suffering damages. That's what he's bound by, and that's what the multiplier should be. Absent any further questions, I will sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bush. Brady Williamson, representing Travelers Indemnity Company of Illinois.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Brady Williamson with Catherine Statler and Jennifer Peterson for the Travelers Indemnity Company of Illinois. Parties have a fundamental difference of opinion, and the statutory disagreement is just the beginning of it. The disagreement goes to due process. It goes to the heart of the United States Constitution and the 14th Amendment. How do we know, several members of this court have asked, when punitive damages are warranted? How do we know? A fair question. The response from the plaintiffs is that, like obscenity, quoting Justice Stewart, we know it when we see it. If you read their brief at page 34, you will find a 156-word explication of that single statement, we will know it when we see it. But putting that aside, that standard doesn't work for obscenity under the First Amendment, and it certainly does not work for punitive damages under the 14th Amendment.
Counsel, I kind of smiled when I got the response that I did when I said, how are we to know? 5 million, you know, 8 million, 15? Because, of course, I'm sitting here and I've read all of this and I'm expecting a fancy response, and I was unarmed probably by the accuracy of the response, that is, the gut, you know, it's your gut. I mean, but you're suggesting, you're going to give me a different response to that.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but the first thing I'm going to tell you, or better put, remind you, is that the Constitution does not permit that kind of standard. And reading, if I might, very briefly from page 417 of State Farm versus Campbell, the reason that we have such strict judicial oversight of punitive damages, the reason that State Farm has imposed a one-to-one ratio as the general rule, is that elementary notions of fairness dictate that a person receive fair notice not only of the conduct that will subject him to punishment, but also of the severity of the penalty that the state will impose. In a standard like we know it when we see it, or 156 words worth of standard, are simply insufficient to provide that basic notice that our Constitution requires. Punitive damages, and I think Justice Butler alluded to this, punitive damages represent an awesome power that we place in the hands of jurors. And we place that power in the hands of jurors only subject to strict judicial review based on balance, based on reasonableness, based on assuring no appeals to bias or emotion. But we also place that emphasis on judicial oversight because the Constitution literally requires us to do that. And almost every question that the court has asked today, even the questions about the statute, go to this elemental notion of fairness and notice of what conduct will engender what kind of response from our judicial system. The plaintiff a moment ago was asked about the relationship between the harm suffered and the punitive damages. And the suggestion was made repeatedly by the plaintiffs that we don't need to look at the award We can look at all sorts of things to develop this ratio, numerator, denominator. But notwithstanding the comments of plaintiffs directed to this bench, the Supreme Court of the United States in Campbell said the relationship is between, and I quote, the amount of harm to the plaintiff in the general damages recovered. The damages recovered. In this case, the damages recovered by the decedents or in their, excuse me, in their name was $4.2 million. The ratio that then develops between $4.2 million and $94 million is 22-1. The number...
Mr. Williamson, let me interrupt you right there. Why can't, in your opinion, the loss of society and companionship be included when we're looking at a ratio situation? And also, along the same lines, why can't a settlement that has occurred in this case also be included?
First, with respect to the loss of companionship, Your Honor, the legislature of this state, for better or for worse, has imposed a $350,000 statutory limit on those kinds of damages. If you, if the court, permitted those to become a multiplier on the way to punitive damages, you would have destroyed the legislature's mandate to put a limit on those kinds of damages. I mean, this court doesn't need to be reminded that those caps are very controversial.
Well, why
but
can't,
they happen
why can't
to be the law.
Why can't we count 350,000 times 3 when looking at the compensatory award here?
Because you would then be, Your Honor, disregarding the mandate of the legislature, which is to cap those damages. Now, your second question was about the $12 million secret settlement that was reached during the trial. And the reason that that can't be a factor is because the jury wasn't aware of it. The parties, other than those who participated in the settlement, weren't aware of it.
What difference does that make whether or not the jury is aware of it if our review is de novo? I understand our review to be what we assess the punitive damages to the damages recovered. So isn't it irrelevant what the jury heard?
No, it's not, Your Honor, because the jury picked this number of $94 million not quite out of thin air, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But the fact is, you can't test a jury's decision, a jury's judgment about punitive damages, without knowing what the evidence was that they heard. And one of the problems with the plaintiff's position is that in their effort to manipulate the ratio, they're asking this court to consider the kitchen sink. The jury didn't get to consider the financial impact on the children because state law doesn't permit it. The jury didn't get to consider the settlement amounts because state law doesn't let juries know about settlement amounts. So then how can this court take those factors into account? Because, Justice Bradley, State Farm has said to us, and I think it is a bright line, that in most, if most cases, the ratio should be 1-1, 1-1, where the compensatory damages are substantial. And the compensatory damages in this tragedy were $4.2 million. And I don't think anyone can contend that that was not substantial. Now, plaintiffs have suggested an interesting little case we call the bedbug case, written by Judge Posner. But Judge Posner's decision in the bedbug case, which had a ratio of 30-some to 1, fits squarely within the exception recognized in State Farm. And that exception is that where damages are inconsequential or difficult to determine, a higher ratio may be warranted. This court presciently used that exception in the Steinberg Homes case, where there was $1 of nominal damages and $100,000 in punitive damages. It may be that the case this court heard this morning where the damages were $2,000 awarded by the jury and 112.5 ratio to punitives, has a little more leeway than 1-to-1 because the damages were relatively nominal. But the damages here were $4.2 million.
Mr. Williamson, if I can take you back for a moment to the CAPS argument that you just made and why we should not consider the capped awards as part of punitives. And I'm not sure I'm going to articulate my question accurately, so I hope I say this right. Part of the argument we heard earlier was that you have to link the actual intent to the injury and to the harm. But now we've got a legislative determination saying, but we're only going to consider, or we're putting a cap on what can be recovered. So in terms of recovery, there's a limit there. But there's still that question as to how much damage or how much harm has actually been accrued by the plaintiffs in this case. How can we ignore that? I'm not sure I'm asking that right, but I think you know where I'm going with that.
I do, Your Honor. First, the Supreme Court in State Farm talks specifically about a ratio that involves the damages awarded by the jury. So let's put that aside for the moment. If the $350,000 cap could be trebled, quadrupled, multiplied by 30 in a punitive award, it would be no cap at all. You would have, again, not the court, but we would have frustrated the purpose of that statutory cap by saying, okay, it's $350,000, but guess what? You can multiply it by 5 or 10 or 15 or 20. There's been a bit of discussion about the Wangen decision, which the Chief Justice wrote in 1980. There has been a sea change in this country with respect to punitive damages since 1980. To call it dramatic would be an understatement. First of all, this court, in a series of decisions since 1980, has repeated time and time again the importance of judicial oversight, of judicial independence and integrity as a check on juries who, well-motivated but emotional, influenced by bias and tragedy like this of unfathomable proportions, make an award that, quite frankly, is unconstitutional. So this court has set a trend. Secondly,
Counsel, I get back to the question I had before with regard to standard of review. Are we, as a court, reviewing the trial, or the jury's verdict of punitive damages, and as a matter of law, determining whether or not they're excessive or correct, or are we, as the dissent said in Trinity, de novo review requires independent evaluation by the reviewing court, which may indeed result in a substitution of the reviewing court's opinion for that of the jury. What are we doing? Is the focus on the accuracy of the jury's award, or is the focus with de novo review whatever we think it is, regardless of what the jury may have said?
Well, first, Your Honor, sometimes the simplest solutions or responses to legal problems really are the wisest responses. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the Court of Appeals was right for the reasons the Court of Appeals said. But putting that aside, on the Constitution, this court has the power to vacate the entire award and to say that the maximum that would have been justified in this case by any jury was 1-to-1, because State Farm dictates that result. This court could also pick another number within the State Farm parameters. MHIA and other parties believe that, as Justice Butler referred to, maybe you can't do anything constitutionally, the whole thing has to go back. I think that raises the specter of a Dickensian history for this case. But putting that aside.
But let me ask you about that, because I was waiting to jump in, and you brought it up. The concern that I have, Mr. Williamson, is we all know, should we find that punitive damages may be appropriate in this case, that's going to be largely fact-driven. Am I correct in that?
No, I disagree with that, Your Honor. There are several cases, including BMW and State Farm, which make it quite clear that in the constitutional context, a punitive damage award is not a finding of fact.
No, not a finding of fact. But in other words, it's going to be driven by the facts that occurred in the courts below. And if there, and that's my question, and this is a question I asked Mr. Habish, if you have 19 unresolved, or now I guess 18 unresolved issues in the court below, and we reach the constitutionality of the excessiveness of the award in this case, and then the case goes back to deal with the other 18 issues, I guess my question is, are we jumping the gun?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, for several reasons. First, I think it's fair to say that a lot of people are waiting on the outcome of this case.
I think you're right.
And the case this morning. We literally have the jury instruction committee issuing a jury instruction that basically says, time out. We're not going to do a new punitive instruction until we get direction here. So, Your Honor, the direct answer to your question is, even if this court said, let's send all this back because MHI is correct, Neil F. Lamson, the designer, should have been on the verdict form. This court would do a disservice to the parties in this case and to the judges and lawyers and litigants of this state if it did not provide firm, clear direction on the constitutional parameters of the award of punitive damages. Let me just say that.
Mr. Williamson, let me interrupt you right there. Are you suggesting that if we find that punitive damages were appropriate here, that we should set the number?
I think you can. Your Honor, I don't think you should find them appropriate. I don't think you should find punitive damages appropriate because the statute, in my view, forbids them.
I understand that. But assuming that we find punitive damages appropriate, do you think we should, or are you urging us to set the number?
I'm urging you to, at the very least, set constitutional parameters. And look, State Farm, Justice Crooks, ended 15 years of reluctance on the part of the United States Supreme Court to set a quantitative standard. But they did set a quantitative standard in State Farm.
Don't you think we set parameters in the Trinity case?
I'm sorry, Ian.
Don't you think we set parameters in the Trinity case, which was decided and issued after State Farm?
Yes, Your Honor. It was issued about 30 days after State Farm, and your 7-to-1 ratio there certainly fell within the dictates of State Farm. And more importantly, this Court has never had a punitive case where the ratio has exceeded any more than 7-to-1, ever.
Counselor, I have one question. Would you agree with me that the legislature set the caps on wrongful death as its policy determination that the amount set was sufficient to compensate for that injury?
Yes.
Okay. And would you also agree with me that punitive damages are not meant to compensate, but rather to punish the wrongdoer?
Absolutely.
Then I don't see why we can't evaluate the wrongful death damages when we look at the ratio in punitive damages. Would you explain to me why I'm wrong with that connection?
First, because the United States Supreme Court and State Farm strongly suggested, if not said, you can't.
We disagree a little on that, but okay.
Secondly, Your Honor, the whole notion of caps are meant to place a ceiling.
But that's for compensation, and punitive damages are not compensatory.
But the Supreme Court in State Farm looks at the relationship between compensation awarded and punitive damages.
Well, that's fine. I don't see where that gets in the way of considering that.
No. Perhaps, Your Honor, this makes the point I was making earlier, which is whatever this Court does in this case, it needs to set some clear guidelines. Otherwise, we will have plaintiffs before the jury comes back, after the jury comes back, saying, oh, well, wait a minute, the ratio is not really 15 to 1, it's only 10 to 1 because this, this, and this. And in this case, of course, that point is driven home because the plaintiffs did not put in any evidence of economic loss. And that makes this platform very unstable. And so not only did you have a jury award 22 times the compensation, you had a jury making that award based on pain and suffering. Now, no one suggests that there wasn't incredible pain and suffering, but the court in State Farm has suggested that that's an unstable platform upon which to base $94 million.
But doesn't that go back to Justice Butler's concern that maybe we don't have enough facts before us to decide what the platform is?
Well, after a six-week trial, Your Honor, I don't know that the issue is a shortage of facts. It's what the jury knew. But if this court decides that there is to be a new trial, it will be a new trial with a new judge and a new jury, and the parties may come at the cases differently.
I'm not sure that's what I was suggesting, Mr. Williamson. What I was suggesting is that there's a multitude of the case that's still out there that hasn't been resolved, and should we reach this issue before the rest of the case gets resolved? I wasn't suggesting the other. All right.
Chief, may I ask a question? Counsel, you referred to the Trinity case and said you're right on, 7-to-1 ratio, and this court has never done anything differently than these single-digit things. And yet the dissent of Trinity would certainly take those of us in the majority to task, and it did, saying this is really a 200-to-1 because the $490,000 that was included in the measurement was $490,000 in potential exposure, not actual harm. How do you respond to that?
Well, first, Justice Bradley, I would observe that counsel should always be wary about discussing a 4-to-3 decision.
Firm grasp of the obvious.
Especially when only one is left.
Perhaps literally, Justice Wilcox, but I hope not in spirit. The $490,000 that Justice Crooks's majority opinion focused on, I think was an appropriate number there. And there are two reasons for that. One is that it was the potential harm to these plaintiffs, not to some other insureds, not to people who may have been in the zone of danger at Miller Park, who, by the way, have their own lawsuits pending, and you certainly cannot count danger or potential harm to them in the equation. And the other reason I think it was appropriate is really because of the bedbug case. The damages in Trinity were difficult to ascertain. The $17,000, Justice Bradley, as you know full well, were legal fees. So I think $490,000 and then the multiple of 7-to-1 was appropriate. But to me, the most important point out of Trinity was the fact that the court said 7-to-1. Not a bigger number. And if you had persuaded your colleagues that the focal point should be $17,000, then the result might well be different. But I want to end on this fundamental point. We're here talking about the Constitution this afternoon and this morning because we go to notions of fundamental fairness. It really is about due process. After hearing the discussion this morning and this afternoon, I also think we're getting into areas of separation of powers as well, but we'll save that for another day. And let me just conclude by a summary statement that Justice Kennedy made in writing State Farm. He said that he found that case neither difficult nor close. This case is difficult because three men died. but both on the statute and on the Constitution. It's not close. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williamson. Mr. Habish, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I think I saved a couple minutes earlier. Do I get any credit for that? No? Okay.
What's gone
is gone. That's right. You know, does anybody with an earshot see the plain language of this statute or any extrinsic sources which support the interpretation placed by Mr. Weber and Mr. Bush? I don't see it. They've never presented it to you. What they're suggesting, this is not Bush on statutory construction, nor even Habush on statutory construction, nor Weber on statutory construction. We can look to Kalam, and although we see two avenues of approach, and I'm not going to get into that war, neither one in this case has supported the position that they take. The plain language does not show intent to injure. It does not show an intentional tort. There is not a scintilla of proof from the legislative record that the legislators ever intended to make this an intentional tort statute or require intent to injury. I know they want it to be that way, and I suspect Judge Fine and Judge Wiedermeyer thought or wanted it to be that way, but members of the court, the plain language and the extrinsic sources don't show that. And if we're not going to follow Kalal, either one system or the other, what are we going to follow? It's chaos. Are lawyers then going to interpret the statute for you? Or are we going to follow established canons of statutory construction? It's not there. If the legislature intended to do what they suggested they intended, they didn't do it. I'm going to just kind of skip around because that's what my notes are, so forgive the incoherence of the process here. Management computer case, the award was 27-1. The court reduced it to 10-1. So there is, Mr. Williamson, a case that is more than 7-1. And might I point out, in all respect, Trinity was what is called mere economic damage, as well as computer services was mere economic damage, and the factors suggest that that's different. And I suggest that it's different as well. We don't quarrel with Kale. We don't quarrel with Liberal. And I hope the courts, and I trust the court's memory of what I said in my opening, they've remembered it better than Mr. Weber or Mr. Bush remembered it. I said the conduct has to cause actual damages. I made that statement. But they suggest and continue to misrepresent our position we take. I asked the court in our reply brief to Mitsubishi, and I say in the summary of Wisher's position, MHIA and other respondents persist in misrepresenting Wisher's position. In the faint hope of cessation of this intentional misrepresentation, we state, well, apparently my hope was misplaced. Number one, Wisher does not believe that any disregard of rights, or in particular, intentional disregard of rights, standing alone, will justify punitive damages. How much more clear can we be that we don't believe any volitional act, we don't believe even intentional disregard of rights standing by itself is going to justify punitive damages? There has to be a qualitative analysis of the type of the conduct. There has to be compensatory damages. There has to be actual damages caused by the conduct. The court will make that determination. This is also from the brief on page 6, our brief. Rotlich and Noel admitted they knew the dangerous effects of wind on the crane and a load the size of 4R3. They knew that it was unsafe to lift the wind speeds of that day or even less, and that it was dangerous to do so without wind calculations, that the crane could tip over and kill people, such as the descendants. And Rotlich agreed he was, to quote the record, reasonably certain prior to July 14, 1999, that if these wind load calculations were not being done with a piece the size of 4R3, not only was it a dangerous practice, but there was a probability that a tragedy could occur.
Counselor, what's missing for me in what you read is that he agrees that if they were not done, a tragedy could occur. What is missing in what you read is that he knew they were not
done. Well, if you look at the record, Justice, Lamson testified that they told Grotlich that they'd have to do the wind speed calculations.
I will look for it.
That's in the record. And Grotlich claims that Lamson was supposed to do it. He does admit that he never checked. And he does admit he knew that they weren't done. Okay? But the jury, the point is, in a jury trial, the jury was entitled to believe one story or the other. And the jury was entitled to believe that Grotlich knew that Lamson wasn't doing the wind sail calculation. And that he was lying on the witness stand. Because there was numerous instances of deceit on the witness stand by Grotlich. State Farm does not stand for a one-to-one ratio, as suggested. And, as I suggested earlier, Trinity is an economic case. And the jury doesn't hear evidence of civil or criminal penalties either. So the jury, and that's a factor that the court takes into consideration, that ratio. So it isn't necessary for the jury to hear that. On probability of injury, members of the court, Sharp and Walter, cases which precede and succeed Brown versus Maxey, use the word potential of harm. The potential of harm is a factor that the court will take into consideration in assessing whether punitive damages are warranted. And obviously, the greater the certainty of harm, the more likely punitive damages will be awarded. But in the Wheeler product liability case, a tire rim mismatch case, the court found that even though the harm was remote, they allowed punitive damages because the consequences were so serious and it was so easy to have prevented the consequences. So it's not in concrete that it has to be probability. And the only reason that they talk about practical certainty is they've already decided that the statute is an intentional tort statute. And under intentional torts, they use the word practical certainty of harm.
Are we close to completion, Mr. Habish?
Yes, I am. Thankfully. What's wrong with this instruction, I ask? 1707.1. That answers the question what intentional disregard of rights is. These people, the committee, looked at the statute, and I think how they read the statute is how everyone else read the statute, and it was only the first time until this case that people read the statute the way the Court of Appeals read the statute. And let me just say one thing. That Mark Galanter, in Shadow Play, The Fabled Menace of Punitive Damages, 1998 Wisconsin Law Review, punctures the myth that punitive damages are such a big problem. They're not a big problem here in Wisconsin. And as a matter of fact, Senator Huelsman, who's one of the sponsors of 895-85, received from the Legislative Council a recent ABA research which said that punitive damages are not routine and extremely high punitive damages are not the norm. Much to do about nothing. A solution looking for a problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Habish. Thank you, Mr. Williamson, Bush, Weber, for your arguments this afternoon. This concludes our hearing in Whistler versus Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, America et al. The court will meet at 4:10 p.m.
That's great.
In conference.